Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. An ambitious project to completely rethink and remake the East Adams neighborhood in Syracuse has recently been put forward. Named Blueprint 15, the area includes three public housing projects, Pioneer Homes, McKinney Manor, and Central Village. The neighborhood lies underneath and runs to the north and south of Highway I-81. Joining me today to discuss Blueprint 15 are two of the project's leaders, Bill Simmons, Executive Director of the Syracuse Housing Authority, and Meg O'Connell, Executive Director of the Allen Family Foundation. The foundation has supported the project's initial planning and will likely be involved in its creation. Meg and Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
And Bill, welcome back. So let me start, Meg, and I'll start with you. If you could just provide a basic, to set the stage, a basic overview of Blueprint 15, what at least at this point is the vision about and why is it being put forward?
So the vision about Blueprint 15 is really that it exists and has been formed to be what we'd call a community quarterback organization. It consists of about 18 to 20 different community leaders and stakeholders that have vested interests and concerns about the neighborhood that we're talking about. It includes, of course, the Syracuse Housing Authority, two commissioners of the Housing Authority, two residents who were appointed to serve on this board, as well as kind of local leaders from business, education, medical, Upstate, Syracuse Community Health Center, educational partners, the superintendent of schools, as well as the EOC. And the purpose of this organization is really to support the Syracuse Housing Authority, as well as to create a vision of a holistic neighborhood revitalization for this neighborhood.
And what were the origins of the idea? I mean, what was the spark that got it going?
I think the spark that got it going is probably goes back to, for a while there's been all these conversations about what's going to happen with I-81 and the impact on that neighborhood. And people, you know, what happened to that neighborhood when I-81 went through was in many ways a racial social justice issue. And I think there's a lot of concerns that we keep having these conversations about 81, but really what does it mean to the neighborhoods and the residents? And it's an area of our city that does have significant challenges related to the housing challenges that the Housing Authority has had. You know, HUD is not putting a lot of money into housing projects and rebuilding housing projects. And so there was an idea to try and say, no, wait a minute, let's really look at a much more broader, more holistic revitalization of what this neighborhood could be. And it has such rich historical and cultural roots as the old 15th Ward. There's really a strong community in all the conversations we've had, really desire to try and as best bring it back to what it used to be.
And Bill, we're in the early stages of this, obviously, and before when we were speaking, the two of you, emphasized that point. But what are some of the main kind of central features that at this point seem to be pretty clear about the way that this project ultimately will take shape? I know that, or I understand anyway, that mixed income housing is one of the important features. What are some of the other things that the hope is that this area will have?
So, yeah, we're looking for mixed income housing and along with some commercial activity in that neighborhood. As you pointed out, the East Adams neighborhood falls into the urban core and is such an ideal place to really invest in the neighborhood and invite opportunity and residents in so that you can make it a pretty much a world-class neighborhood whereby you have, you deconcentrate poverty and you create opportunity for the residents that will, in a way that help them break the cycle of poverty, but most importantly, get those residents new housing. Pioneer Homes, which has been around the first public housing development in New York State and one of the first in the country, built in 1937, are totally inadequate for family needs today. And so, as Meg pointed out, the HUD has systematically divested itself in public housing throughout the country. And so there's an opportunity for housing authorities now to develop and redevelop their properties with the monies from the private sector.
And just like the issue of what are drivers going to do while I-81 is being either replaced by a grid or rebuilt or tunnelized or whichever way we go on that. The same question comes up for a project like this is what do the residents do while this is going on? So first of all, just basic question, will everyone who's currently living in the housing projects have the ability to live in the new housing? How are you going to work that?
So oftentimes, the New York State, what HUD requires when you're doing a project like that, where you're totally demolishing all the units and rebuilding the streets, each resident a tenant protection voucher, meaning that they will get a voucher to relocate pretty much anywhere they want in the country or in any neighborhood. And then they have the right to come back to the development once it's fully completed. So you would do this in phases so that the vast majority of the residents
can
take advantage at one time. And so because there are so many moving parts, like the decision about I-81 and what's going to happen, we've decided to work in the areas furthest from I-81 and work our way back. And hopefully we'll know more in the years to come, and that will dictate a lot of the rest of the phasing.
And since these folks are poor, that's why they're in these housing projects. I assume that they will probably stay local rather than relocate to California or something. And so, are you working on finding other housing in the city to accommodate that? How's that going to go?
Well, we'll do the phasing in such a way and on a scale that the rest of the city can accommodate the relocation. Relatively easy. But as you know, we've been working on this for so long that most of the tenants have become kind of experts on housing choice vouchers. And so they know that they can take that voucher anywhere in the country, whether they have family and friends down in Charlotte, Atlanta, New Jersey, and they have those vouchers pretty much for life. So many people are thinking of broader than just the immediate neighborhood, knowing that public housing is probably some of the better housing in the city, and so it may be difficult for them to find what they already have in many cases. But we will do the relocation on a scale and in such a way that the local housing market can accommodate those transfers if necessary. But most of the residents are pretty sophisticated about how the housing choice voucher works, and they know that they can relocate outside the area.
This is a conversation for another day. We don't have time for it here, but there's a whole issue about people being able to use those Section 8 vouchers, and there's been some investigative reporting on that it's more complicated than it might be if you're going to another town. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Allen Family Foundation Executive Director Meg O'Connell and Syracuse Housing Authority Executive Director Bill Simmons. So, Meg, come back to you. I just want to give you a chance to emphasize something you emphasized to me before we got on air, but this is in its early stages. I mean, say a little bit about that, and then we'll move on to other topics.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point. What we're really announcing now is more kind of this partnership between the Syracuse Housing Authority, Blueprint 15, and a consulting entity called Purpose Built Communities, which we can talk a little bit more about. But essentially, there are no plans. There's no architectural drawings. Blueprint 15, in partnership with the Syracuse Housing Authority, has issued an RFP for a master developer. Once that master developer comes on late spring, there will then be a whole planning process that will be very comprehensive in terms of community engagement, resident involvement. And that's really critical because we don't want to really present that there is a plan that people haven't even had an opportunity to participate in.
It's a concept at this point.
It's a concept. It's a vision. And I think it's just trying to say that let's think about how we can do something differently.
So for either of you, who wants to jump in on this, but even though it's a concept, is there an idea of what the estimated cost is going to be for doing something like this that will be borne, the cost that will be borne by at least public taxpayer funds and nonprofit funds, as opposed to what investors are going to bring to the table and put in on their end? Any idea?
Well, Meg can probably speak best to the Blueprint 15 and the philanthropy and the holistic components and how they're going to go about bringing all those components together. From a housing standpoint, all of the traditional models and dollars for building low-income and affordable housing, like tax credits and bondings and home loan banks, all of those tools that even the state of New York has provided for affordable housing. We will be using that mix of dollars to redevelop and develop these new properties.
But it must be a big, I mean, it's a big ambitious project. I think somewhere I saw $100 million in print. I don't know. Maybe that was in the Post Standard, but Meg.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Bill said, you have the housing component, which also entails changing the streetscape and the way that the right now there are more courtyards. I think that there's a lot of desire to kind of change a lot of the infrastructure in the roads, everything related to that. But as part of our model, you know, if you just kind of tear down housing and rebuild new housing, that is not going to change over a neighborhood. I mean, especially a neighborhood, how are you going to make it more amenitized that will really make that more of a desired community? And again, we are using the framework around the purpose-built communities because they've done this successfully in 22 other cities across the country. And so what also would go in addition to the housing costs and where the $100 million plus would come from is the desire to make sure that we have really strong health and wellness opportunities. So a partnership like with the YMCA to build a Y, making sure that we also have really strong creator to career educational opportunities, right? If you're a family and you want to move into this neighborhood when it's revitalized, you're going to want a good school. Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to that, you're going to want an early learning childcare center as well. So that's a key component as well. And then what we're also looking at is also, as Bill mentioned, that there has to be mixed commercial. You have to have people that have opportunities for jobs, people to start businesses in these neighborhoods. So all of that together, when you look at that, is kind of what drives up the price. And I think that there's been comparables done for other purpose-built communities that can kind of give you that $100 million plus budget.
Okay, and I want to get into that question of the model that you might be using from elsewhere in a few minutes. But let me just stick with this for a minute and ask what is, I guess, kind of a touchy subject in the Syracuse area, which is the use of tax incentives for these things. Is there any plans at this point, Bill, that you would think to use tax incentives to get businesses to locate in this area?
Well, once we bring our master developer on board, and we have quite a few that have expressed an interest in being a part of this project, then you sort of begin to, you know, as Meg said, have an engaging process where, you know, residents and employees and stakeholders are all sort of involved in helping creating the vision. But this area, when you talk about taxpayer incentives, this area falls under the opportunity zone because it's in a it was chosen because of the census area for poverty, but the city and the state saw it as an opportunity to really make the kinds of investment in housing, as we have done in the past with the Syracuse Housing Authority. We even used the 9% and 4% tax credits to build new properties. And those the concept of the tax credit program is having investors like banks invest in the neighborhood, put the dollars up for these properties to develop, and they get a write-off for a period of time. Those are the kinds of private dollars that come into an initiative like this and really gives everyone an opportunity to benefit.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Allen Family Foundation Executive Director Meg O'Connell and Syracuse Housing Authority Executive Director Bill Simmons. And we're discussing a new vision, a planning project for the area underneath I-81 in Syracuse, and it's titled Blueprint 15. Now, Meg, the purpose-built communities have been invoked a couple times, and as you mentioned, you've been working with this Atlanta-based nonprofit organization, and I guess it all started with the East Lake Project in Atlanta. Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit later. But first of all, what kinds of services will you be looking for from the purpose-built communities and thinking about this project and actually putting it together?
So purpose-built communities is essentially a kind of free consulting service. I mean, they have to choose to come in and work with your community.
They choose you,
right? Yeah. And I think that that's really important. So when we kind of started, you know, 2+ years ago, almost 3 years ago, trying to look at concentrated poverty and other concerns, you know, we were trying to figure out what other nationally organization was kind of struggling with some of the same issues that Syracuse has. I mean, we're not that unique in some ways. And so that is where I kind of found my way to purpose-built communities. Carol Naughton, the president, she actually came and spoke at SU 2.5 years ago, was invited by the law school to speak here. And she kind of outlined how their framework works. They started in 2001 in the Eastlake Village neighborhood area of Atlanta. And at that time, it was very similar, a public housing project that actually was far worse in many ways in terms of the crime rates, the vacant properties. And over the period of the last 20 years has really turned around that neighborhood. And what happened was after they started all of their work, they started to have other communities that came to them, New Orleans, Charlotte, Wilmington, Omaha, I mean, all these other cities that said, hey, what did you do? Because we have some of those same challenges. And in 2007, they founded the Purpose Built Communities as a consulting service. And what they do is they really come and they help advise, work through with the knowledge that they have, how you kind of envision a whole holistic revitalization, what that needs to be. They have a lot of data behind what they have shown to be effective. They look at a collective impact model. And so that's pretty much what how we've been working with them.
And you mentioned that they've done this with 22 other neighborhoods. Is there one out of that 22, at least as far as you're aware when you were looking at it, that you think maps the best onto Syracuse where you say, okay, maybe this will be the model?
You know, I think Bill actually and the Housing Authority has seen some of more communities than I've even seen because of his travels and stuff like that. But New Orleans seems to resonate a little bit, even though it's in the South and has a little different on the supply demand side. That's been an urban revitalization project. Columbus, Ohio also seems to be very similar. And then there's another one, 75 North in Omaha, that also seems to compare. I mean, I think they're all a little different. Wilmington, Delaware is one that's right now very similar to us, a public housing project that is kind of in the beginning stages of their plans.
And Bill, I want to ask you a question about that in a minute, but let me go in a slightly different direction here for a second. How will the community that's currently living in the neighborhood be involved in the decision-making surrounding the project? I mean, that's very important, obviously. What methods that do you foresee using in order to make sure that happens?
Well, I think when you have a developer on board, a master developer on board, they bring the additional staffing and expertise to have a number of community engagement meetings and make sure that your entire tenant base is involved with it, along with employees and stakeholders, and a complete process whereby, similar to what we did before a few years ago when we had a planning group on board. You meet with individual groups in their developments and have these planning charrettes to find out what type of housing stock residents would like to have, what types of activities, what they would like to see happen in their schools. And then from having these planning charrettes, you'd start to build a vision for the neighborhood and what opportunities, what maybe even commercial opportunities you might want to have on that planning footprint, whether it's going to be a grocery store. Do you want daycare? Do you want banking institutions? The kinds of services that really make a community holistic and create job opportunities as well.
And then that master developer then takes that back and solicits projects or tries to encourage projects that match that vision then.
Correct.
I see. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guests are Bill Simmons, Executive Director of the Syracuse Housing Authority, and Meg O'Connell, Executive Director of the Allen Family Foundation. So, Bill, I want to stick with you and come back to this community of Eastlake. And one of the central aspects of the vision, at least as I have read about it, that we haven't talked about too much yet, is the emphasis on the mixed-income housing. In other words, there will be people who will be, relative to the poorer residents, quite affluent, all living together in this larger neighborhood in sort of different, I guess, levels of housing, so to speak, or different expense, different cost points in terms of housing. One of the criticisms of the Eastlake community in Atlanta, which I'm sure you're thinking about, is that it cherry-picked the previous residents who were allowed to stay. And in the end, my understanding is only a quarter of the original residents return to Eastlake. That may not end up being your closest model that you follow. Meg, you mentioned a couple other cities there. But how will the project – I mean, you spoke to this earlier when you talked about the process of how people will be moved out and moved back in. But how are you going to avoid that particular pitfall? If in the end you've got a successful mixed-income area that's thriving, but only a quarter of the original residents were there, in some ways that won't be a success, I would think. So how will you – avoid that?
Well, the success of the program is going to always be the concept of having mixed-income communities working together and for the residents who are there creating opportunities and role modeling for one another. So whenever, even in public housing today, we have a lot of transient members who will move from one community to another. Some people will get a housing choice voucher and feel that they've moved into a community that's a great opportunity for them and their family and may not want to come back. So it's going to be very difficult to say that 100% didn't come back and so was unsuccessful. 100% may not come back because they may not want to come back. And that's what the whole point of thing we're doing here is giving people choice that they don't have today. And so so if you're looking at, let's say, what's going to really determine the successfulness of this is if we have on this footprint 1,000 families that are low income, and when it's all said and done, we have another 1,000 families that are low income, that's the success of the program. And so you have all these residents working together and families that are in a position to be more role models and break up the concentrated poverty, families that are, you know, working every day, taking care of their property, spending time with their families, networking with other families that may be of different incomes. If I'm a doctor working up on the hill and there's a family that it's young and low income and their daughter's getting ready to graduate from our stellar public school, and they say, well, there's some nursing opportunities, Mrs. Jones. I know your daughter's turning 18. Do you think she might be interested in working up there? That breaks the cycle of poverty, creates the kind of, you know, the network that we're trying to build in the community and make things successful. Not that 100% of the residents that moved out didn't move back in. That's not going to be the measure of success.
And there's evidence to suggest that when you're able to achieve that kind of mixed income living environment, that everybody benefits. There's
absolutely
a pretty good social science on that. There's another feature, and I don't mean to keep hammering on Eastlake, but Meg, I wanted to ask you this because it struck me, really. In looking at the Eastlake community, one of the things that struck me was the central role played by the Eastlake Golf Club, which was in that community. And that it played a central role, at least in my understanding, as an ongoing source of funding. It's a golf club that has become very tony, apparently, has high fees for membership. And for corporate members, there's an expectation that the corporation or the organization will contribute to the local community. Is there a need for some kind of ongoing core revenue source that is able to perennially be giving to the community, that's attached to the community? Is that part of the general model?
I think in Eastlake, that was just the model how it worked. That's really unique. In the other 21 sites, network cities of purpose built, they don't have that kind of connection. And in some ways, I think that purpose-built communities in Carroll Naughton would tell you that for years, the golf course was it kind of just came with the land at the time when they it was adjacent to the projects. And so, it wasn't a revenue generator. I mean, I think that, there are so many great examples of social enterprises, both in our community and nationally, that can support not-for-profits. But it would not be our intention in this project per se. You know, I think what's important is that the long-term sustainability in some ways for this project are twofold. First of all, as Bill mentioned, mixed-income housing, I think there have been concerns that, this neighborhood's going to completely change over its proximity to, such large employers. But the Housing Authority will always retain the ownership of the land, right? This is a land lease agreement, right? So the Housing Authority will always ensure permanent affordability. That's without a question. But I think the other aspects of trying to build out some of the other amenities are going to require philanthropic and other resources to build them and to support them. But over time, the goal would always be that this neighborhood becomes sustainable, because that is what is the goal and model.
And we only have about 3 minutes left, but I've saved the hardest question, maybe or maybe not, we'll see, for last. It's literally looming over this neighborhood is the question of I-81. So, because this housing area is under and around it. Does the plan assume, Bill, or does it require even a particular outcome for what will be done with I-81? Because we still don't know for sure.
Oh, correct. No, it doesn't require a certain outcome. The Housing Authority has taken the position that we support the street grid option.
Okay.
That street grid option complements the housing plans, complement our housing plans the best. But regardless of what decision was made up with I-81, this type of investment in the community needs to happen. And so it's not dependent upon the I-81 decision.
And Meg, different version of this. We only have about a minute left, but there's probably going to be an association in people's minds, though, between the grid and this, even though, as Bill just said, the project can work with a retained viaduct. How's that going to work for getting the support maybe of some of the suburbs that you want in on this?
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, as someone who kind of lives in those suburbs and has come out for the community grid pretty vocally, you know, I really believe that everything has to come down in our perspective to what's in the best interest of the residents and this city, and the ability to bring that highway down to the community grid and connect both our largest employers up onto the hill into these neighborhoods only seems like a real win-win for the future of our city.
And Bill, last thoughts on this in terms of your pie in the sky vision on this. I mean, in 30 seconds, what would be the ultimate thing that you'd want to see come out of this?
You know, you would have just some great quality housing that are safer and encourage walkability in the community where and wellness, and a school district or a school that encourages education and has high performance. These are the things that we know are going to be beneficial to people and break the cycle of poverty and make it a world-class neighborhood right here in central New York.
Well, if this project is able to do that, it'll certainly be, I think, well worth the investment. That was Bill Simmons and Meg O'Connell, and I want to thank the two of you again for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.